I'm Donna Loring. Today on Wabanaki Windows, we're focusing on the Wabanaki Alliance, why it was formed, the work it does, and why it matters now. Joining us are Molly and Bryant and Darren Ranko. Molly and Bryant is the former ambassador for the Penobscot Nation and is now executive director of the Wabanaki Alliance, helping lead coordinated statewide efforts to advance Wabanaki sovereignty. Darren Ranko is an associate professor of anthropology at the University of Maine and a citizen of the Penobscot Nation, whose scholarship examines sovereignty, history, and policy affecting Wabanaki nations. And I'll note here for full transparency that I serve as vice president of the Wabanaki Alliance. So Mollyann, tell us about Wabanaki Alliance, the history of the organization, and what it was, or what it is created to do.
Sure. So the Wabanaki Alliance was formed in 2020, and it was around this time where the tribes had all really come together around working on amending the 1980 Maine Indian Land Claim Settlement Act. That's the federal piece of the law, and then the Maine Implementing Act, the state piece of the law, from 1980. So of course, you know, brief history there is the tribes and the federal government sued the state of Maine over roughly two-thirds of the state that had been illegally taken from the tribes. And the result of all this was a settlement that dealt with land and money to an extent. I think that's even debatable. But also the state was able to put in some really oppressive and long-lasting policy into these settlements that restricted tribal rights in a big way. There's a lot of jurisdictional restrictions, and then there's also a clause that effectively blocks the Wabanaki tribal nations from accessing federal Indian laws meant to benefit tribes. So back in 2019, I was serving as the Penobscot Nation tribal ambassador, and the state pulled together this task force of state leaders, tribal leaders, the former judiciary chairs, and even some non-voting members from the governor's office and the attorney general's office and the Maine Indian Tribal State Commission. So that group met six or seven times and studied the settlement acts. They talked about federal Indian law. They heard from experts, and they came up with a set of 22 consensus recommendations. And these recommendations are on a host of topics from criminal and civil jurisdiction, fish and game, natural resources, access to federal laws, and all of the things we'd like to see fixed were sort of put into this body of recommendations from the task force. So the Wabanaki Alliance was formed because tribal leaders, it is no surprise to anyone that when you have five different communities, not everyone agrees on everything. Not everyone has all the same priorities or goals or visions or histories or even languages, but the tribal leaders at that time were really focused on the work of that task force. And I think everyone agreed that amending the Settlement Act in a big way and making meaningful changes on that set of policies was needed for all the tribal nations. So the Wabanaki Alliance was formed by tribal chiefs, tribal leaders. I got to serve as the president of the board of directors before I stepped into the executive director role. And we really had a sharp focus on advocating for the priorities of the tribal nations. So the way our sort of process works is the tribes come together, decide which bills they'd like to oppose, which bills they'd like to support, and then we work in the Wabanaki Alliance to sort of activate our coalition and really do what we can to advocate for these pieces of legislation. I think we're also really focused on education, and we have a whole network of folks throughout the state that help us table at different events and gatherings. So we've really grown and shifted and done a lot of good work in these past almost 6 years, and it really goes back to that sharp focus on tribal sovereignty that was born of that task force work.
So there's a community, misunderstanding or whatever, that the Alliance works for or is directly connected to the tribes in a legal way or whatever. Is that, can you explain that relationship? Kind of,
Sure, and
yeah.
yeah, and I think the confusion is valid. So the Wabanaki Alliance is a 501c4 nonprofit, so we can do advocacy and work on legislation and all that sort of thing. And the board of directors and advisory board is made up of tribal citizens, and a lot of the folks are either past or present tribal leadership. So right now we have Donna Loring for the Penobscot Nation. We have former Vice Chief Richard Soliboy for Mi'kmaq. We have former tribal representative, former chief Rena Newell for Sabaic. We have current tribal representative Erin Dana for Madoc-Mi-Gook. And then we have current Maliseet Ambassador Zeke Crofton McDonald for Maliseet and Houlton. And so I think folks sometimes see this great group of tribal leaders on the board, and then our advisory board is the most of the chiefs. So they think, well, this must, the decisions must flow in a certain way in the Wabanaki Alliance. I think we're really careful to not ever get ahead of the tribal administrations and tribal chiefs. We really want to take our cues from them. So I think it forces us to be extra careful that we're not taking positions before any of the tribal nations do, and we follow a really clear process, because we don't want folks to think that we're making any policy decisions or strategy calls or any of that sort of thing. We come in to advocate for existing priorities.
So how is it addressed, I guess, when the tribes really disagree on an issue, some for, some against? What's the position the alliance chooses to take?
Oftentimes, in a situation like that, we won't take a position. If we can't get a clear consensus from the board that we should act one way or another on a piece of legislation, we just won't weigh in on it. And that can get tricky, because you do have tribal leaders and citizens that may feel very strongly for or against something, but I think we take it very seriously as the Wabanaki Alliance that we want to promote unity. And there are plenty of folks out there that would love to see us divided. So we stick to unity as much as we can. And if we don't have resounding consensus on an issue, we usually just won't testify on it.
What are the bills that the Wabanaki Alliance has dealt with since its inception? And that's what, a few years ago?
Yeah, all kinds of bills. It's been
That's a
kind
big
of
question, right?
a wild ride. I think we've seen the bulk of our advocacy work has been around the legislation produced from that task force work. So we saw some large omnibus bills. There was LD 1626 a few sessions ago, and that was sort of the bulk of those task force recommendations. Governor Mills isn't too keen on broad changes in law about tribal sovereignty. So those large efforts haven't reached her. And then other efforts she has outright vetoed around access to federal Indian law. There have been a there was a bill specifically focused on getting federal beneficial acts applicable to the Wabanaki Nations, and we actually had gotten some really great Republican support on that. So we were hoping for a supermajority and to override her veto. We had the numbers in the first couple of votes, and then after she vetoed the bill, she had done, some, not just her, folks had done some hard work between the veto and the override vote to sway, I think, 12 Republicans to flip back. So we lost that vote in the House by only a few votes, but we have really strong Democratic support on a lot of these issues. So those have been sort of, I started with the sad stuff. We haven't gotten those big omnibus bills passed or the federal beneficial acts. There have been some victories. We have gotten access to the Federal Violence Against Women Act. We've gotten some taxation provisions restored to the tribes. We've restored some criminal justice provisions to tribal courts. And of course, we've gotten into some gaming revenue with a bill that legalized sports betting and with exclusive rights to the revenue to the tribal nations. So it's sort of been all over the board. There's some really focused things about sovereignty. There's some very large efforts. And then there's some sort of outlier things about gaming Wabanaki studies. There's an active effort around that right now. So yeah, a whole host of things that we've been able to work on.
Yeah, so that was a quick list. So going back to the 1626 bill, omnibus bill, I think that was the first one, right?
Yes.
You said that it hadn't reached her, the large efforts on this bill and the amendments, what it hadn't reached her. What did you mean by that?
So that was a wild time. We're thinking, oh, the spring of 2022, there was the Omnibus Bill 1626 that the Wabanaki Alliance had been able to get all kinds of support. People around the state were riled up. We had a Zoom hearing for this. It was back in the days where a lot of things happened on Zoom, and I think it went over 8 hours. Mainers were really excited about tribal sovereignty, and it felt really cool. The governor was also very aware of that momentum and support that we had really riled up throughout the state. So she had been negotiating a compromise bill at the same time. And that was LD 585, and that had three provisions in it. There was the taxation provisions, which are really good, and it's great that we were able to get those for the tribal nations. There's also in that three-part bill a tribal collaboration policy. So Governor Paul LePage, before Janet Mills, had rescinded a tribal consultation order. So we were looking to get something back on the books about even talking to tribes and having a, in statute a relationship. So that was part of that bill. And then the third part of that bill was the online sports betting. So we have 1626 is the omnibus bill, 585 is the compromise. And also at the same time was LD 906 from Rena Newell from Sabaic. And that was all about amending the Settlement Act to help Sabaic get clean drinking water. It's a human rights crisis that the community there doesn't have clean drinking water. And the governor, we had heard that there were signals out there. If the omnibus bill reaches the governor, she may veto all three bills. So it's tough for tribal leaders to be constantly between a rock and a hard place of, do we push for full sovereignty? Do we do what we can to get all these bills to her? If it means we're playing this game of chicken of we might not get these other things we've worked really hard for, and also we might stop this really promising effort for Sabaic to try to get clean drinking water. So when you have all of those things in the mix, it gets really, really hard to make decisions you think might be easy. So the 1626 was on the appropriations table. So when a bill costs any amount of money, they slap on what's called a fiscal note. And then that bill, even if it's made it through the whole process, it has to go back to the Committee on Appropriations and Financial Affairs to be considered for funding. So towards the end of this session, all three bills had passed. The 1626, the omnibus bill with the task force recommendations, had a fiscal note, so it sat on the appropriations table, and the governor did not want it to reach her. So there was this sort of dramatic Senate session where some senators were trying to take it off the table, and other senators knew the tribes might not want it off the table because it meant putting those other two bills in jeopardy. So at the end of the day, it died on the appropriations table. And the other two bills were signed into law, the compromise bill with those three provisions around gaming collaboration and taxation, and the clean drinking water bill for Sabaic.
Okay, so Darren, I'm going to go to you. Do you have any comments on this? I don't know, on what Mullian has just mentioned on the bills and in general.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Donna. I'm so glad Mullian's joining us today. And I think I mean, I really see the Wabanaki Alliance, its creation, as really shifting an articulation of tribal sort of needs and expressions of sovereignty into a really new era, new level of it. I think it's an extension, in my opinion, though, of the kind of work that you did, Donna, when you were in the legislature, politicking the way that you did to support certain bills getting passed, the Wabanaki culture and history law, et cetera, et cetera. But I think, it's as an expression of really working through and having it kind of always ever present within the state legislature is a really kind of these last 5 years or so, 5 or 6 years has really pushed our expressions of what our sovereignty means to us into a new threshold, right? So it's as opposed to, the off. I think it's one of the best ways that we've been able to express ourselves as Wabanaki people. The alliance, Malian talked about some of the educational pieces, but I think most of what the alliance does, or a lot of what the alliance does, is constantly updating and educating our, the line work. I think Malian is educating and communicating with the legislators, right, in the state. There's a report that you issue annually too that assesses and gives a sense for both native and non-native folks across the state who's in support of this, who isn't. It creates all sorts of like action points for working in the context of the state legislature in a really new and important way. While the biggest successes haven't happened yet, I really feel like it's been, and you can say like there's been a whole host of things that have happened in the last 20 years, again, starting, with your time in the legislature, Donna, but then, things like the Penobscot River Restoration Project or the Truth and Reconciliation Commission work, or the, and there have been a series of articulations that have shown, us fighting for our rights in ways that are an extension of our traditional diplomacies, but really articulating why this is important to us in ways that are more readily available to not only our own tribal citizens, but obviously everyone in the state. And so I think that that's been a huge shift. I think, I mean, I used to hear you say, Donna, like, Democrats, Republicans really didn't matter back in the day. Like it was, I think now that it does matter. I think, our constituencies and our alliances with, I think, a lot of the Democratic leadership has made a difference, has meant that, let's not think about, remove the top Democrat from the governor who has this veto power and threat of it that Mullian articulated very well. Like, I think to me, that's a very new thing. Like, it's hard to explain to my like white ally friends, like how in the bad old days the Democrats were as anti sovereignty as the Republicans, or even that there was a way to even articulate that. That has changed, and I think the alliance. I mean, I think there's a lot of important and good work that has been done by people, again, like the two of you, in articulating this and working, doing the hard work. Basically, meeting, educating people, re-meeting, re-educating. New people who come in. Like it's the everyday hard work of what, politics can be. And I think it's just pushed things for us in a really new and important way. I think one thing that, I serve as one of the Penobscot Nation representatives on the Maine Indian Tribal State Commission. I think the ways in which that entity was designed as a mediation entity in some ways, or as a place to come together, which has never, probably, I don't think I'm speaking out of turn, never fully functioned as its intent, or at least as the way that the intent that we understood it as tribal citizens, as a kind of resolution space. I think I think moving it into a more a clearer sort of articulation of the politics from just the alliance as a tribal representation of our desires, our needs, our goals, I think has also meant that the half steps of like already negotiated ideas that might come out of something like a Mitsik as a joint entity between state and tribes is also shifted what roles that has to do. I think Mitsik has other roles and opportunities in the way that the Implementing Act has been worded and things like we're working on issues around like boundary waters and the regulatory sort of framework around that, which is designed in the Implementing Act as something that the Mitsik has some real control over and would articulate both tribal and state desires around joint collaborations and all those things. So I think even as a Mitsik representative, I see the creation of the alliance as a really important step forward that also has, in some ways, I think Mitsik rethinking. I think before it was one of those areas, and I think we're involved. Mitsik had been involved earlier on in trying to create the frameworks of like this omnibus bills and things like that. And I think a lot of the groundwork that Mitsik laid did make it easier for the group that came up with the 22 points to kind of really articulate that in a clear way. So yeah, I see it as really important steps forward. And I'm really excited about what's next. I think even no matter who's governor next, I think people are not taking super hardened positions on tribal affairs. I've already talked to Molly Ann about this. I think there's going to be a lot of like frameworks for education and engaging with the next race for governor that the alliance is well positioned to take. I mean, I think even when Molly Ann was our ambassador at Penobscot Nation, like she did a lot of work to bring the governor's candidates to our tribe at Penobscot. But I see that, and I know you guys will do this at the Alliance, Molly Ann, to like really make tribal issues not just like an afterthought to the governor's race, but to really center it for, again, not only our tribal citizens, but more broadly across the state. So I'm really excited about that kind of work, which will make it, people have to take some positions on these things, as they run for governor in the next race. So I think it opens up a lot of those discussions and engagements that are really critical for the future of our sovereignty. So, yeah.
Yeah, Somalian, has the alliance done, or I should say, what has the alliance done in the area of educating the general public and the legislators?
Yeah, I think we look at that in a couple different ways. We've been able to hold events like panel discussions. You both were involved in a very recent one we did in Gardner in September called From Treaties to Today, and that featured Darren as our moderator and Donna as a lifelong expert on these things, and also Ambassador Crofton McDonald, who is president of our board currently and is sort of an expert on treaties. Well, not sort of, he is very, very knowledgeable. So he was able to share a lot of that. So you have those efforts where it's a big event, we're pulling people in, they're usually very well attended, great discussion. And then there's a lot of sort of grassroots going around to events, conferences, country fairs, concerts, tribal celebrations. And we have this amazing network of volunteers that work within our coalition of supporters, and they work with us to have tables at those events with handouts and displays. So you'll see us doing a lot of that work. A lot of it is relationship building with lawmakers. It's being there in the state house, walking around the hallways, getting to know folks. I was so lucky that I had a couple really good friends serving when I first started as ambassador. Ben Collings from Portland was a state rep back then. He really showed me the ropes, huge champion of our rights. So he did so much in helping me get sort of integrated into the state house culture and getting to know people. So that's a big part of things, building those relationships that way. We've also been able to be involved in statewide referendum races on the ballot. We've had two of those that we've helped be successful, and one was question six a couple of years ago. And that started with a bill from Senator Rachel Talbot Ross, another big champion of our rights. And the bill was to reprint copies in copies of our state constitution. They had removed language that spelled out the treaty obligations that Maine took on from Massachusetts when Maine became a state. So about 50 years after statehood, there was this constitutional convention, and it was decided, who knows why, to remove that language from the printed copies of the Constitution. So even though, spoiler alert, Maine didn't follow those treaties and didn't respect them whatsoever, the language was legally, quote unquote, in effect, even though it wasn't printed. So really kind of shady things happening, trying to hide history. So we were able to get a referendum question on the ballot. Would you like to have that language back in the printed copies of the Constitution? And that question passed overwhelmingly. I think in the 70% of Mainers wanted that language back in the Constitution. So that was a great effort that the Wabanaki Alliance got to sort of champion and dip our toe in the water in a statewide campaign. And then just last year, we helped as part of a coalition. There was a question on the ballot about voter ID. And on its face, voter ID is a pretty popular thing with a lot of folks. But what the crafters of this effort did was add in a whole lot of voter suppression measures into the wording of that question. And the consequences would have been pretty bad for a lot of people. And it had some language in there. If voter ID was put into effect, you wouldn't be able to use tribal IDs at the polling place. So we were excluded, in that part of the question. So the Wabanaki Alliance got involved and took a position and joined the coalition and really got word out about these harmful provisions. And that question failed by a whole lot. So that feels good that we've been able to sort of infuse ourselves into statewide issues, and as Mainers are going to the ballot box, they're able to hear from Wabanaki voices about how some of these questions might affect our people. And then the last piece about education, I think, we've done a really good job in framing these issues for everyday Mainers. We've worked with folks on putting reports out there. We've worked with the Harvard researchers. There's a whole report about kind of rural Maine economies and how the restrictions on tribes are holding back all Mainers. And then we also worked with the Maine Center for Economic Development on a report about land being sort of the central piece of a lot of this policy chaos. And that report also has some pieces about how if tribes had rights and access to land and sort of more freedoms, it would help all of Maine. So through partnerships, a lot of hustling on the ground, and then sort of larger events, we've been able to really be present and representing a whole lot of issues that are important to Wabanaki people.
Okay. There's a couple questions I want to give to you, Darren. One is you remember the Constitution question, the language? I know you and I both did some public education on that. You want to speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, the going back to the question six, and the erasure of the treaty obligations from the Articles of Separation, that part of the state constitution that happened in the 1870s. I think the I mean, there's some interesting disagreements around like why was that slated for removal. I think there's some evidence too, like there are two arguments that are put forward. One of them is that the state didn't see these obligations as pertinent anymore, and therefore just removed it in a more general way. I think there's also some evidence that there was a Passamaquoddy land case called Avery versus Granger that also had been moving through the state courts, and they kept citing the treaty obligations and the language of treaties in that particular case, which, surprise, surprise, we didn't win. I think that, it was a growing frustration by the state, which saw no obligation, no honoring of obligations from the state of Massachusetts, to the fact that, geez, they keep bringing up these treaties and that we're on the hook for them. We should wish they would just stop doing that kind of energy. And I think, there's a series of court cases, and you can go back to, Murch versus Tomer. We've talked about that from the 1840s, all the way through to the State versus Newell case, which effectively removed our treaty hunting and fishing rights in 1890. Basically, you can't read the case State versus Newell and the way that the presiding court basically said, like, by removing our treaty hunting and fishing rights, they basically had to say, like, the entities now before us that are expressing these treaty rights are not the same entity that signed these treaties with our forefathers, right? So they had to get people to believe in the court opinion in State versus Newell that somehow the Passamaquoddy tribe, ironically, which they kept calling the Passamaquoddy tribe in the legal proceedings, was no longer the Passamaquoddy tribe. So, it's classic colonial like mislogics, twistery, et cetera, that you can see in these cases, but as an expression starting, in state from statehood to the end of the 19th century, not wanting to recognize these obligations legally. And so the idea that the state was acting illegally or mistrustfully, is like a very consistent pattern. And Donna, we've documented that in many, many shows here in terms of this radio show. And I think, that just shows the thinking. But it's clearly aimed, and the idea of resistance to it. I mean, I think it's really interesting that, and I kind of want to think about this in the larger logics of resistance to our sovereignty. Like, what is it when people are trying to hide history, right? Or erase history from us? What does that look like? Or, one of the things that I recognized early on when I mean, I guess I knew this already, but when I was appointed to Mitzik by our tribe, the state commissioners then, and there were more of them, many of them have resigned and not been replaced. But I think how hard the representatives, some of the representatives from the state, see our sovereignty as a zero-sum game, meaning the more rights we have as tribal governments, tribal nations, tribal citizens, somehow that would be an attack against the state sovereignty or state control or state well-being. And I feel like a lot of what the alliance has been doing in a successful way is to really articulate, and Mullian mentioned this, report from Harvard, which clearly shows how when states resist tribal sovereignty, that actually hurts states, right? Like that the idea that there is a zero-sum game going on is a really, I think to me that's the most alarming part of the resistance to our sovereignty. And because I'm a scholar, I'm fact-based. Like let's talk about facts. Let's talk about, what actually happens in states when the tribes are strongly supported in our sovereignty. Oh, it just happens that those states, especially in rural areas, benefit dramatically from expressions of tribal sovereignty. I would think anyone would want to support that and support the work of tribes in that context. So I think it really is like, for me, like much like erasing history or obligation, erasing or not wanting to address, the facts of what a strong articulation of tribal sovereignty looks like and how it actually benefits the state of Maine, to me, is a very interesting kind of like hide the ball of like, I mean, it's no surprise how politics works in, 2025, 2026, that like truth is like hard to find in any of these spaces. But to me, I think it's a really important, an important part of the articulation that the Alliance does is to recenter and disrupt these very false narratives. So the idea that it's a zero-sum game, that we should somehow erase, or that if we so if we allow this history to be articulated in printed documents of our Constitution, that would confuse people or create an action, or I think those are arguments that I would want us to all collectively examine, like who makes those kinds of arguments, like who is in support of holding a history quiet or silent, and who is against, the full facts and articulations of our sovereignty and its impact on the state. Like, what would that actually look like? I think that it's always fighting against the threats of fear, right? The fear-based elements of, well, if the tribes get this, who knows what could happen? We'll assume that it's bad, as opposed to extremely positive for the state. So I think, to me, all those things are why the alliance is important and why these articulations are so important.
Darren, I'm glad you brought up the confusion piece because that's the argument that we always get.
Yeah, I know.
I don't care what it is. If they don't want something ha to happen, it's, oh, that's going to be confusing. We don't know what's going to happen there. That's the unknown. But in this particular case with the Constitution, it was pretty obvious that everybody wanted that language back in
That's right.
because what state takes out pieces of their constitution to for not for for you know so the public can't read it. You talk about confusion. That's pretty confusing to me when a state does that. So this administration, this governor was the only one that was against putting that language publicly back into the Constitution. Everybody else, the Attorney General, Secretary of State, legislature, they all were for it.
That's right.
That's,
And
that's a
74%, as Molly pointed out, 74% of the people who voted in that election were for it as well.
absolutely. And I can't think of any more of a blatant example of the governor's refusal to recognize tribal sovereignty than that.
And I think that idea of confusion or uncertainty, right, as a bugaboo, or like this, and this was, I got so frustrated in my early year or two of being on MITSIC when there were some more state voices, honestly, because they would say things like, and this is sort of an articulation that I hear from the governor at times as well, which is, I have questions. I'm unsure about this. I have questions, and I'll be like, of course, I'm a big professor, and I'm like, okay, well, I have knowledge. Like, I could share, like, what are your questions? Maybe we can answer them right here. Like, I don't know what my questions are yet. Like that, to me, that's a political articulation, not a an articulation of like, I'm actually confused, right? Like, if you were actually confused and had questions, you wouldn't be able to know what those questions were. As opposed to when someone says, like, I'm unsure about this, I have questions, and you're like, what are your questions? I'm not sure yet. Or I had this back and forth a number of times where when Congressman Golden put forward his bill for the federal laws and it being impacted by them for in the Settlement Act, right, that we would be presumptively opted into all federal legislation for benefits of tribes. when that legislation was put forward, I was like, oh, I actually think at least the way he, we read through his bill in the way that he modified the Settlement Act, in terms of that language. And I thought, I was like, oh, that's pretty brilliant, because it wasn't even like, it was just removing certain words. And I was like, oh, well, so why would you state commissioners be opposed to this? And they were like, well, I'm not, it creates all this uncertainty. And I was like, I actually think, like, well, what uncertainty would it create for you? Like, and then again, what part, where in his legislation? Well, I haven't actually read it yet. Like they can comment on things they haven't read yet. They can comment and be questioning of things that they don't even know what their questions are. I think, to me, this is bad faith, right? This is not a way of dealing respectfully with a party in a commission, right? Like, if you come to the table that way, to me, that shows disrespect, right? Like, I don't mind the disagreements, but like, let's talk about the disagreements, not the hide the ball of like, I'm not sure what my disagreements are, I just know I have disagreements. Then we're not really having a conversation, and like, education is not very helpful in those situations. So yeah, I mean, I could go on and on, but I think that coupled with the zero-sum game elements of the of our articulations of sovereignty to strike me as the ones that I actually hear less and less of. I think, I think it was around the omnibus bill, like, where I heard that most in the press and from the governor's office. I haven't heard those. I think they've relied upon, like, we want to negotiate these things one at a time kind of like thoughts around this, as opposed to that language of uncertainty, although those are often twins in the resistance to sovereignty bills. So I really, yeah, I mean, I think, to me, always, as an educator, as a scholar, like, education is always the best antidote to that. And I think that's why I do this radio show. I think, we reach various publics in what this is about, because I think most people are like, have a position on things and they don't know why. I think it's more like, oh, yeah, someone said, like, if the tribes are sovereign, then that harms me. Like, well, actually, no, it actually helps you. Like, think about it that way for a sec. And so I think, those are the things that I really am excited about for the next race for governor, the next articulation. I think once we get out of the cycle of this governor and this legislature, more things will be possible, and I think there's a lot of work the Alliance did with Republicans too around the eminent domain bill. I think that shows that there are many Republicans who are like, why was I against this? Like, I wouldn't want the state to seize my land, like that sort of thing. Like, those kinds of discussions are really, really thought-provoking and pushing people forward.
Molly, and we first of all, I'll let you talk because I'm, Darren took up a lot of air here. So, so if
Donna,
you
I
had,
know that's what you really wanted from me.
right, it is. Mullian, you have some comments?
I do, and my first comment is I am always up for listening to Darren talk. Darren is an absolute treasure. We are so lucky to have him share his knowledge so generously all the time. I did want to, I misspoke earlier. The report that we worked on was with Maine Center for Economic Policy, MESEP. I think I said development instead of policy, so I want to make sure I get that right. And yeah, I think thinking about a lot of this, going back to a series on Wabanaki Windows, the ICE series you did, which is relevant in a couple of ways right now. So the state of Maine stole all this land, never wanted to be held accountable for that, and then utilized the perceived superiority over tribal people in really gross, awful ways for a long, long time. Cutting off connection to traditional hunting and fishing, cutting off connection to land, pushing us into smaller pieces of land. When you do all that to a people and then you outlaw the religion and then you steal the children, what does that leave us with? And how does that leave the state of Maine And why would they ever want to deal with either one of those two truths? We had in our communities, I know you talked at length about this, but the Indian agents, where you had people working for the state and they could decide how people spent money or traveled or if they could buy fuel. And you had, I know one case of someone freezing to death because the application to buy fuel was denied. So the state has a whole lot of blood on its hands. And I think that when we see the erasure, the resistance, the false, sense of, like Darren was talking about, this zero-sum game. When you hear, oh, this is too big, this is too broad, this is too much, it's not too big or too broad, it's too much, it's too real, it's too true. And they're afraid that if we start pulling at this thread of any sort of improvement for Wabanaki people in Maine, it untangles this whole thing that they've built over so many generations. And when you have folks like Governor Janet Mills, like Senator Angus King, who were sort of that time working in proximity to these policies in 1980, feeling really good that the state walked away with quote unquote settling the Indian problem and having these things set in stone that the state would maintain the superiority, maintain this paternalism, they're terrified to undo any little bit of that. So this work is so important because we're getting out into Maine and we're talking about, look, there is this history. It's not your fault, but someone has to deal with it now, you know? And Wabanaki people, we've been dealing with it for a long, long time. So why don't we work on these changes together and shed some light on all of this? And instead of keeping everyone in the dark, which doesn't benefit anybody, we make some policy changes and we improve life for all Mainers. So that's really what I think about. I think a lot of times this pushback on these things is based in a real deep fear of history coming back and history being pulled out into the open. And some people embrace that. Some people think, yes, there is darkness. Let's learn about it and from it. And some people would rather it stay in the dark so that we can live in this fantasy land of the state of Maine has done all these great things for tribal people, and it's more than made up for the land theft and all the other atrocities. It hasn't, and it won't until we fix these policies and maybe someday see that whole settlement thrown away and we do something better.
I agree with that 100%.
I know you
Yeah,
do.
absolutely. And thank you for saying that. Darren, comments about that?
Yeah, I think I mean, this is so profoundly true what Mullian just said, and how we think about those issues. One of the ironies, I think, also when I think about what you just said in this context was, in the 22 recommendations, I remember it being that we were asked to remove the gaming pieces of that, right, from those recommendations, right, in the omnibus bill. I think that was what, with Rena and her bill and the veto there. That ironically, of course, we have bills now, like in many ways our biggest advances have been on some of the gaming pieces. Sports, you mentioned the sports gaming one, and there's the recent internet gaming bill that Governor Mills did not veto. I find that, like, part of the ironies of this work, like, always, that we're told we can't have that, and then we're like, okay, well, we'll put that aside for a minute, and like we'll work on some of these other core issues, because what we're yeah exactly what we're talking about is a really great thinker on this, had a recent editorial about this that we in the Portland Press Herald. We had a we asked for sovereignty and we got iGaming. I think that Donna Loring wrote this really brilliant piece about, why is it that in some ways, while our economic opportunities are so critical to our tribes, like our sovereign economic opportunities are far more compelling, or would be highlighted because by our tribal governments. Like, I'm not saying like the internet, gaming, any of that stuff is not important. It is important, and it does create a really important economic base for our tribes. But in many ways, that's a small a part of an overall economic set of sovereignties for us as tribes, which would actually benefit, again, the rest of Maine even more significantly if we actually had our full sort of suite of economic sovereignties that is sort of caught in these omnibus bills. Like, I just think that it's an interesting, where we've gained ground, like, and where where we're told don't go there, and then we're like, okay, we agree not to go there, and then they're like, oh, we'll give you that thing. Like, it feels like it's like some sort of like psyop or something. Like, I don't know, there's some sort of way that I feel like we're being like really tugged around all the time by this. And again, I say that not because I'm not hopeful, but I think I am hopeful because I feel like those breakages through represent something more significant that's possible.
Malian, you have comments?
Oh, absolutely. I think as we think about this gaming issue, you hear different opinions from different tribal people, and I think they're all correct. And I think the real problem is that gaming has been used as a tool. It's like dangling a carrot of like, I'm not going to go all the way over here and respect tribal sovereignty, but I will sort of appease you with these gaming advances. And that none of that is the fault of any tribal person. That is flowing down from the top. That is colonization at work in 2026. And it's wrong. And I frankly am tired of it. And I'm looking forward to new leadership, we hope, that will have a full understanding and embrace of tribal sovereignty. And I will give a quick little plug for WabanakiAlliance.com. Our bill tracker has current legislation. We have LD 785, which is an omnibus effort with a lot of those task force recommendations. We have LD 395, which is about access to federal Indian law. Both of those bills are with Senator Rachel Talbot Ross as the lead sponsor. And I think it'll be interesting to see how this all shakes out in this big electoral year. We will be holding forums for public education and we will be highlighting candidates. We'll be unveiling a scorecard about this legislative session. So that's a really key piece of the Wabanaki Alliance work too, in partnership with legislative work, also drawing analysis and conclusions about these lawmakers and decision makers and letting the public see where everyone is at about tribal issues.
Well, our time is almost up here, and we really didn't get into the next legislative session of bills that are coming up. So I'm going to do a part two for this show so that we can talk about those bills that will be in the next legislative session. And hopefully we'll have Senator Talbot Ross at the table when we talk, and maybe a few others. So, Darren, a couple more minutes left. I'll give them to you.
Oh yeah. No, I think that'd be great, 'cause again, being on MITSIC, we're tracking these bills as well. I think the Alliance obviously is the lead on this. We I'm really excited about even some small bills just as a preview, like that we're working I've been working in with Wabanaki Commission on Land and Stewardship. Some of the land trusts and the tribes in the state to really advance the tools that the tribes have when it comes to conserving and getting land returned. And so there's a really small bill that is making its way through, and Mullin could add to that. It's had its own fun little history, but I think it's looking pretty good, at least to be v voted on. Which would recognize tribes to be to hold The ability to hold conservation easements, which would give tribes an additional tool when it comes to the management of, especially our fee lands, I think, and land transactions with land trusts, but also to recognize, and this is pretty significant, I'd say this is slightly more significant, recognize that conservation easements can be held for sort of the cultural purposes of how we as tribal nations would want to govern our lands and steward our lands and care for our lands. And I think that's a tool that only exists in West Coast states, where you see a lot of tribes having large roles with and significant roles in with land trusts and conservation groups, because the easements themselves can recognize that our stewardship and care is a reason to conserve land. So I think that's a really excellent, small step, but I think some really nice tools for our tribal governments going forward. And so that's my little preview of, possible bills that we might talk about in part two.
Okay, Mullion. Any bills coming up?
Yeah, sounds great. I'm glad we're doing a part two. The two ones that I mentioned, and then there's also LD 1474, sponsored by Rep. Lori Osher from Orono, and that is to support ongoing Wabanaki studies work. So of course we have the groundbreaking historic bill from 2001, sponsored by Donna Loring, to require the teaching of Wabanaki studies in Maine schools, and the state finally sort of put that into practice with a Penobscot educator working in DOE, and this bill would seek to fund that and really make sure that that work keeps going.
Okay, thank you both. You've been listening to Wabanaki Windows. What we've discussed today sets the stage for what comes next. In part two of this series, we'll focus squarely on the legislation being considered this session. Legislation that goes to the heart of sovereignty, self-determination, and justice for the Wabanaki nations. We hope you'll join us as we continue this vital conversation. Thank you for joining us, and tune in again next month for another Wabanaki Windows.